From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn more about what prompted Governor Walker's decision to close the Lincoln Hills Juvenile Prison.
Plus, how important will the interim chief of police appointment be?
I don't think that it's a stopgap measure. I see it as something different. I see it as an opportunity for the Fire and Police Commission to put someone in there who very much is a part of the change.
Later, British writer Ian Woolridge talks about the challenges of adapting the classic novella Animal Farm for the stage.
There was a kind of imaginative exercise, if you like, in adapting it, in that you have to create scenes that aren't necessarily in the book, but which are true to the book.
And we'll meet a Milwaukee man who has turned decluttering into a million-dollar business.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Lincoln Hills School has been plagued by allegations of abuse and mismanagement for years.
The people in charge of the juvenile correctional facility located in Irma, Wisconsin, have been accused of harming inmates in their care, teens whose injuries required hospitalization and, in at least one case, amputation. Now, Governor Walker has announced a plan to close Lincoln Hills School and open five regional centers to deal with juvenile offenders.
Patrick Marley has been reporting this story for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins me now. Patrick, let's take this story back to the start. Where did all of this begin?
I'd say the root of many of the problems that you have at Lincoln Hills began in 2011. That's when they closed Ethan Allen School, which was based in Waukesha County, and moved all of the inmates up to Lincoln Hills, which is north of Wausau. The overall juvenile population in the state had been declining, and so they centralized them in one location. They added girls' wing called Copper Lake Schools there. And over time, a number of problems that developed that the Department of Corrections became aware of at the end of 2014. These included allegations that inmates were being injured by guards. They began an internal investigation and within a couple of months asked the State Department of Justice to begin its investigation, which began 3 years ago this month in January of 2015.
When was the Walker administration first notified about possible abuses at the facility?
So the Walker administration took over in 2011, and they were the ones who closed the Ethan Allen School. A year later, a judge in Racine County wrote a letter to the governor detailing a very harrowing experience of one inmate he had learned of who had been there, who had been sexually assaulted and knocked out. And when staff became aware of it, they waited for a sporting event to finish before they got him medical attention. And when the judge learned of this, he was very shocked and upset. It led to Racine County changing how often or restricting greatly the number of students it sends to Lincoln Hills. The judge detailed this in a letter to the governor. The governor's staff reviewed it, but says the governor himself didn't see it. That's really the first point at which alarm bells should have been going off for state officials.
Did they take any action at that time?
It was a very limited response to it. The judge, who I've spoken with a couple of times, said he never heard from anybody about what happened. The Racine County did a pretty thorough investigation because it was an inmate from their community that this happened to. At one point, he contacted officials up at Lincoln Hills and asked what had gone wrong, about why there had been this delay in getting medical attention for this boy. And someone at Lincoln Hills told him, what did you want us to do, stop the basketball game? So the Department of Corrections did, after all of this came to light, took some actions, but it really wasn't until the internal investigations began 2 or 3 years later that they started making any substantive changes, such as giving greatly more training to the people who work there and equipping them with body cameras.
So when these internal investigations began, what were they looking for and what did they find?
So the Public Defender's Office in Milwaukee County had learned of a number of very serious concerns that were raised. As I mentioned, claims that wrists had been broken or that inmates had been left in solitary confinement for very long periods of time. The provided that information to the Department of Corrections, which initially had some difficulty because, you know, many times they weren't given the names of either inmates or of the staff who had allegedly done these things. And they tried to get to the bottom of individual cases, and they did learn of some things. They turned up enough information that they passed – I shouldn't say they passed it off. While they continued their internal investigation, they also asked for the State Department of Justice to conduct its criminal investigation. The internal investigations, most of which were done in 2015, did result in a number of people being fired or resulted in people retiring or resigning amid the investigations. And then the criminal investigation sort of continued to build. But there have been no charges at this point as we're hitting the 3-year mark on this criminal investigation.
And that's one of the big questions. So there haven't been any charges. Have there been any kind of penalties?
Well, I mean, if you consider people losing their jobs penalties, yes. In terms of the criminal investigation in December, this past December, there were at least 2 letters sent to former guards from prosecutors telling them that they could be charged. The incident we know about that they're looking at happened in March of 2015, where someone's arm was broken or seriously injured. And we don't know what else prosecutors might decide is something that they could charge. We don't even know in that case if they will ultimately issue charges. But prosecutors say these types of cases are very complicated and can be hard when you're trying to determine whether patterns of things happened. You have witnesses and victims who sometimes are unreliable. You may have, amid some very serious, valid concerns, some trumped up or exaggerated claims that they have to wade through. And, you know, you have many times inmates who, after they're released from Lincoln Hills, may be hard to track down again. They may not remember well when something happened or the names of the staff who were involved. So that's what people who defend the long time of the case contend as to why it's taken as long as it has.
As you mentioned, a lot of these issues seem to start around 2011 when these other facilities were closed. But do we know if there were issues at Lincoln Hills before then?
Yes, I don't think we have a great picture of that, but it does seem that some of the claims and concerns about Lincoln Hills go back before 2011. You know, there have been some very serious training concerns there, that staff were trained improperly for some time, for years, it appears, into, you know, different techniques that they should use to stabilize or secure inmates that would not be in keeping with national standards and could be dangerous in some cases.
And the person who was the head of training was actually one of the folks who retired / resigned in that long string of people.
Yes, the head trainer, Dusty Munier, was investigated for a great number of incidents that had occurred that he was involved with or that he was responsible for reviewing that appeared troubling to internal investigators that he signed off on as, you know, in keeping with the department policies. He did resign amid a very lengthy investigation of him.
So last week, Governor Walker announced there is a plan to close Lincoln Hills and open 5 regional centers for teens around the state. What's the goal there? What are they hoping to accomplish with these new centers?
So this would go to a model that has been the one championed by advocates for juvenile justice reform. It's sort of the national standard of having fewer youth in a smaller facility and as close to their homes as possible. That way they can see family on a regular basis. They can access services that they will continue to use when they're released. They'll be near their community. The belief is that, and then with the smaller group setting, you can have a staff ratio that allows for more sort of a treatment approach than a correctional prison type approach. The idea being here that these are very young kids, some of whom have committed very serious crimes, but that you have the best chance of turning around their lives and keeping them out of sort of becoming a lifelong criminal or lifelong prisoner if you address issues as early as possible.
What have critics said about this plan?
So they have, you know, big picture, they support the governor. He's gotten a lot of support from Democrats and from juvenile inmate advocates who have in the past been very critical of him, though they still say that this is coming too late. He should have done it sooner. and they're concerned about the timeline he has. They want it to happen faster. His plan would be that you get legislative approval in the summer of 2019. Then you build these facilities, and then you convert Lincoln Hills from a juvenile facility to an adult prison. You know, that could be 3 or more years from now that inmates would actually be moved into these new centers. And Democrats in the legislature say we ought to do it this spring, that you could at least start planning where these facilities are going to be, issue the bonds to build them, and, you know, shave a year and a half off of the timeline.
Are there any concerns about the timing of the announcement?
Sure. The Democrats are critical of him, of the governor, for not doing more sooner, and say that with him announcing this in January of an election year, that they're concerned that it's a political ploy in some way. But at the same time, they say they like the direction that he's going in, and that he should be applauded for, you know, going to the kinds of policies that they want. The governor says he didn't act sooner because he needed time to evaluate what the best plan was. He didn't want to do a knee-jerk reaction. He consulted with Milwaukee County, which has the largest population for Lincoln Hills, and that he was trying to do things right so that when they make this changeover, it's the best system we could possibly have.
All right. Well, Patrick Marley, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Joy.
Patrick Marley is a Madison-based reporter covering state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There is more on his reporting on Wisconsin's juvenile correctional facility, Lincoln Hills, at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we look to the challenges ahead for the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission as it begins the process of finding a new chief of police. This is Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. And I'm Joy Powers. Members of the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission will meet later this week to discuss the process of appointing an acting chief of police. That meeting comes a few days after current chief Edward Flynn announced he will retire from the position. Flynn has been the chief of police for the past decade and will step down 6 weeks from now.
One person who has some informed thoughts about Flynn's tenure, the coming appointment of an acting chief, and the search for a new chief of police is Annie Schwartz. Schwartz served as Flynn's spokeswoman for his first 5 years as chief, having served in that role for the previous chief, Nan Hagerty. She worked for a couple of years as a spokeswoman for the state's Department of Justice after leaving the MPD and now advises law enforcement agencies around the world on communication strategies. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
Well, let me get your immediate reaction to the news this week that Chief Flynn is stepping down from his post. Were you at all surprised that it came at this point in time?
I don't know if we would use the word surprised, but I want to use the word optimistic, because we're going to have a complete change in law enforcement leadership in southeastern Wisconsin. We're going to have a new police chief, going to have a new sheriff, going to have a new U.S. Marshal, going to have a new U.S. attorney for the Eastern District, and we have an attorney general at the state level who says, I want to work with local law enforcement. So I'm optimistic. I think it'll be good to have a chief of police who wants to cooperate with all of the different entities that need to be together, that need to work together to solve the issues that we're facing in the city of Milwaukee and in southeastern Wisconsin.
Let's talk about what happens immediately, though, because there's going to be an interim police chief appointed in the coming days. And, you know, I think a lot of people look at that as, okay, so this is just a stopgap kind of measure. What's the importance of that appointment?
I don't think that it's a stopgap measure. I see it as something different. I see it as an opportunity for the Fire and Police Commission to put someone in there who very much is a part of the change that we're going to be seeing in the police department. I think that the commission is going to sit and have a conversation that says, if we want business as usual, then we will pick some. We will pick the usual suspects. If we don't want business as usual, if we really want to show, even just with this interim appointment, that we are going to change, then perhaps they're going to look at some of the captains in the police department, as well as just the assistant chiefs or inspectors. I think that they will look very closely at others in the department, maybe some of those that were relegated to other positions because they didn't necessarily agree with the administration. I think that is possible.
What sort of coordination do you think, either official or unofficial, has to take place with all of these appointments that are taking place? Do you need a police chief in the end who somehow gels well with a person who's named the new sheriff?
I think that it's going to be essential that this new police chief can get along, which is what we say about our kids. But it's going to be essential that this new chief and this new sheriff are able to work together for the benefit of the entire county. I don't know that we have seen that in the past. So there's an opportunity there. I don't know that we need to choose people based on whether or not they can get along with each other. I think we need to choose people who we know can get the job done. And if you have two people who want to get the job done in their individual agencies, then you have the right person for the job.
You spent 5 years as Chief Flynn's spokeswoman, 3 years before that as Nan Haggerty's spokeswoman, and before that you were on the other side of the equation. What do you think? I guess let's talk a little bit about the communication process that comes out of the chief's office and out of MPD and police departments as a whole. First of all, you know, what did you think the lessons that you brought with you from your time as a reporter were to the work of, I guess, sharing the story of the Milwaukee Police Department?
I think that Nan Haggerty saw the value in having a civilian in that role, and especially a civilian that has worked as a reporter. So what she appreciated, and then what Chief Flynn kept me on to do, was to bring that perspective of the reporters, because telling the story is not just a recitation of the facts. Telling the story means creating some of that content, whether you create it yourself, which we started under Chief Haggerty and then continued under Chief Flynn, which was that idea of coming up with a branding campaign for the department. We worked with Kramer Krasselt, with a local advertising agency, to get that done.
Why was that so important?
It's very important because what we're doing is we treat our companies like a brand. We must also treat our agency like a brand, because we need the same thing in the public sector that private sector companies need. We need people to trust us. We need people to have faith in our product. Our product, of course, is violence prevention and law enforcement and cops. We need to have people have a positive feeling about those things. So that's why we tell the good stories. Your tax dollars are paying for the police, so don't you want to know what's happening with your money? So all of those things are key in storytelling. We also have to get out and tell the bad stories. We have to educate. And I would say that's the number one piece, is that I learned this at the police department and I learned this at DOJ, that both police officers and lawyers always think that you know, okay, well, this is easy to explain. But the general public doesn't always understand that. Sometimes you have to explain to people in a little bit more of a broad way why you're putting this policy into place. It's not good enough just to say they're doing it everywhere. They're doing it in all the big cities. They're doing it in LA. You have to be able to say, this is why it's good for Milwaukee, and let me teach you about this business.
Do you think that has been a shortcoming at the Milwaukee Police Department since you left? Your civilian position was eliminated 5 years ago.
Correct. I think that in the last few years, there hasn't been as much storytelling as I liked to do when I was there. And Chief Flynn and I worked very well together in telling those stories. But I have not been there for the past few years, so I don't know what changed internally. I do know that that sworn law enforcement now provides that advice, and the shot against me when I first came there was that all the police officers were saying, oh, she's coming from the dark side. But that's what helped me figure out how to get our message out there. And that's how I continue to help both police officers and prosecutors all over the country are asking the same question. How do we tell our story? It's even more important post-Ferguson, post-August 2014. We have to tell our story even when we don't want to. And it's not just the police that are learning that. It's also prosecutors. Because it used to be kind of the dad reason, you know, because I said so. That's, you know, well, tell us more about the investigation. We can't talk about it. We can't say that anymore. We have to get out, and we proactively have to talk about and educate the public, at least for procedure. You know, how does that investigation work? How do police shooting investigations work? Why does it take so long? We can't expect people to say, oh, well, the police said they're investigating, so I won't worry about it. The community won't stand for that anymore.
At the same time, it's a challenge, I imagine, to do that at a time when every word that someone says can be dissected ad infinitum across social media and potentially, you know, used back against them.
Social media has both been a boon and the bane of law enforcement. You are seeing police departments that use it wonderfully. I've seen it used in Seattle. LAPD was one of the first in the country. Boston was one of the first in the country. And I was very proud to be part of that group because Milwaukee was one of the first in the country as well when it comes to law enforcement agencies to use social media in a new way. Now, to say that, you sound like you're 200 years old.
Exactly.
Because it's just a given. What is your Twitter account for your agency? What about your Facebook account? So I'm very proud that we were able to put those things into place at the police department. I think that they're going forward, there are some ways to use that even further.
Such as?
I think that we can use social media more proactively than we do, both in the policing sector and also in the prosecution sector. We have seen Twitter especially and Facebook to some extent be a tool of emergency communication when something is going on. I think that that we've seen a great example of that would be the Los Angeles World Airports when they had the Terminal 3 shooting. Social media is the only means they had to try and communicate with all of these passengers that had evacuated the terminal. So building on the social media use to build relationships with your audience, with your readers, not just to give them information, but build a relationship. Tell them the story about this officer. Bring them in. Let them get to know you, because that's that deposit we need in the bank of community trust when we have to talk about a police shooting.
Is there some assumption that has to be made that even in the midst of a relationship like that, there's still going to be some level either of distrust or just discomfort between some stakeholders and the police department? Is it too much to ask for a police chief or a police department to be liked by all people at all times?
Of course. It is. It's a challenge. But it's not so much to be liked. It's just to be transparent or to be communicative, to tell the story somehow. Maybe not everybody's going to like the story. And we had a number of incidents that occurred when I was at the Milwaukee Police Department where we shared the results of some investigation that was not positive for the police department with the public. And while they might not have been happy with the police department because of what occurred or because there was an officer who did something, you know, inappropriate, we always got kudos for sharing the story, for telling people about it. If you have to eat crow, eat it while it's warm. Deliver your own bad news is always what I teach both police agencies and prosecutors around the country. Tell your own story, even if it's bad, because then at least you're controlling your story.
Either in your experience or maybe across the past 10 years, what do you see as Chief Flynn's high water mark, if you will? And what do you think, where do you think he fell short most?
I think Chief Flynn did a great job of sharing Milwaukee's successes and just sharing Milwaukee in general with the national policing circles. Milwaukee has been mentioned a lot more because of Chief Flynn when it comes to discussions about what are some best practices in policing nationwide. I think that that he brought us technology. I think that once he brought us a lot of the different technological resources that we've used, there are things for the next chief to build on, whether it's policies involving body-worn cameras, whether it is policies on allowing officers to somehow use social media so that it's not just one voice speaking for the department, but we also, again, in keeping with that idea that we want to let people get to know us, to talk about how are some other ways that, that those line officers can use that. So I think that, that becoming part of the national conversation is something we can absolutely give Chief Flynn kudos for. From my chair, I'm disappointed that there hasn't been more storytelling, and I would like to see more of that. I think also the we need to have a chief of police here that wants to cooperate with all different agencies and with the private sector as well. You know, we're when we're analyzing violent crime, we have to involve the hospitals. We have to involve other agencies. We have to involve the schools. That I think is where we may have fallen short here. Is in we could do better, let's say, when it comes to cooperation with other agencies.
Is there an inherent push-pull between, I guess, two key stakeholders here? If a police chief is saying he's especially responsive to the community, does he get some distrust from the rank and file in the department, and vice versa? If he makes a decision that backs up his police officers, are there some in the community who are necessarily going to say, well, he's just supporting his police officers?
When you are transparent, when you get in front of your audience and you say, this is the situation, that it's hard to argue with that. There are still people inside the police department that say we shouldn't be giving so much information out. You shouldn't be talking so much to the media. Facebook, worst idea ever, because, you know, people can comment there. We don't want that. But I think far and wide that getting out and educating the public about what we do, whether it's ride-alongs for reporters or for lawmakers or other stakeholders, I think that we need to bring people in closer to educating them about what we do. I also believe that before we send out all the news releases and all the information to the public that we do, we have to feed our family first. You have to share that internally with law enforcement, because one thing that you hear commonly is, well, if I want to find out what's happening in my department, I just watch the news. Office, the rank and file don't appreciate that, and then you end up with problems like leaks. You end up with people information sharing where they shouldn't. And then you also kind of are building a constituency inside your department that's not for you. So I always go back to the messaging piece. I always go back to the communications piece. I think that is a key to building those relationships and to sharing information and to building trust going forward, both internally and externally.
Is there a single key trait you think the next police chief should have?
I think they need to be a good communicator. I think Chief Flynn, when he first came here, he was an excellent communicator. He could hold a room like nobody I've ever seen. And I've worked with a lot of people over the years. He was an amazing communicator. And that is the first step to getting out there to tell your story. Because you can have a great story. You have to figure out who's going to get out there and tell it for you.
You said Chief Flynn, when he first got here, was that kind of communicator. Do you think he lost his way over the course of those 10 years?
I think a lot of things happened in the last few years. I think that there have been a number of high-profile incidents where we have seen that the community, that the officers, perhaps that the Fire and Police Commission, all of these bodies have lost confidence in the police department and perhaps in its leadership. So certainly the Fire and Police Commission is going to look at that. They're going to look at you know, who is the person in the interim that can start us on that path. And then who is the person that can come and take the helm of the Milwaukee Police Department and bring it back to being one of the marquee agencies in this country?
Annie Schwartz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Annie Schwartz was a Milwaukee television reporter for 26 years before going on to work for the Milwaukee Police Department. She served as Chief Nan Haggerty's spokeswoman before joining Chief Ed Flynn's staff during his first 5 years on the job.
She went on to a similar role with the Department of Justice and now is a consultant to law enforcement agencies around the world. You can find more of our coverage of Chief Flynn and the search for his replacement at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then we'll speak with the man behind the adaptation of Animal Farm, now showing at the Milwaukee Rep. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. George Orwell's Animal Farm is a book many of us studied in school. You probably learned that the book is a thinly veiled allegory whose political animals and their actions closely resembled what led to the Russian Revolution and the beginnings of the totalitarian Soviet state.
A stage version now open at the Milwaukee Rep illustrates the timeless power of Orwell's story. This particular adaptation has been performed around the world, and it's the work of British writer Ian Woolridge. He joins Lake Effect's Bonnie North via telephone and talks about what it took to create this version of Orwell's story.
Well, I think the format within which I had to deliver a piece of theatre, and that was that I was working for a what we would call over here a small-scale touring theatre company, which was working mainly in high schools, and I had the limitation of only six actors. That was all I could afford. And I had to do it within a certain time frame, like, you know, within the timetable of a high school day. There was very little money for set or costumes, so we had to keep it simple. So there were all sorts of very practical constraints alongside the whole business of adapting, yeah, as you say, an iconic piece of literature. And I think that that was about trying to be true to the piece, trying to be honest about it, and taking everything that we needed and recognizing there were certain things. You couldn't include everything. It was going to be too big. So, you know, we had to cut our cloth according to our circumstances.
Reading it now, of course, I haven't seen it yet, but in reading it, I was struck by, in some ways, how Brechtian it was in the way it was just very presentational. And like you said, it got everything we needed to know. And yet, as I'm remembering the book, as I was reading it, thinking, wow, you know, you've managed to somehow capture the essence of these characters and of this situation without going into, and it wasn't a terribly long book, but still very dense.
It's not. Yeah, I expressed it in the sense that it's telling a story, and very directly so. I mean, most of it is narration. There's very little dialogue in the actual, you know, book itself by Orwell, which I remember when I chose to adapt it and to put it out into schools, then, you know, I got a bit of a shock when I actually reread it and thought, wow, I'm going to have to create dialogue here. Which is what I set out to do, but also, again, remaining very true to the spirit of the original. So there was a kind of imaginative exercise, if you like, in adapting it, in that you have to create scenes that aren't necessarily in the book, but which are true to the book.
When you went back to read it, obviously you found it held up, and people still read it, and it still holds up, even though the world has changed profoundly in some ways since the time it was written. Was that a challenge as well, to make it somehow feel timeless?
Well, I think it is timeless, full stop. I mean, you don't have to really do anything to it at all, because the young people, the students who saw it when we first did it in Glasgow in the 80s, they knew very little about the Russian Revolution, but they immediately related it to the politics of the day. And therefore, I think it is always timely, because it's about power, it's about abuse of power, it's about leadership. It's intensely political and could never fail to be so. So that, you know, the whole business of the history of the piece and the fact that it was written as a satire of a particular country's political development, that's obviously important, but you don't need to know about that in order to be able to relate it to now. So that when I wrote it in the 80s, people related to the period of time that we had just been through. They related to people like Idi Amin, the Ugandan dictator. They related to Margaret Thatcher, who was a relatively new prime minister in Britain. And today they will no doubt relate it to political leaders of today.
I know it is frighteningly prescient, isn't it?
Well, and it always will be, because it serves as a warning to society at any stage in history, that, you know, you have to watch leadership very carefully, because if you don't, then it's going to damage you in some way.
Right. What is it? Absolute power corrupts absolutely?
That's right. That's right. And I mean, all sorts of things like Churchill's quotation, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics, you know, and statistics are used in Animal Farm as a way of justifying the procurement of power. And we're still living with that. I mean, we're inundated with statistics, with different political sides trying to prove points as a result of giving us a lot of figures.
Right. And as you say, used in service to an ideology.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, in many respects, the more polarized the world has become, and I think it has become more polarized since certainly I did the adaptation. I mean, you know, it's very interesting how what's happening in this country at the moment is virtually a 50-50 split over a major political issue. I believe the same is true in the United States. It's 50-50. So, you know, the world is becoming more polarized. There's a trend here, and that reflects something about this story and how we deal with power, how we deal with leadership, and how we can't allow ourselves to be duped by it.
If you were to adapt it today, would you change it in any way?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, Bonnie. I mean, the one regret I had after I'd written it, and this was about the number of actors and how, you know, many parts each actor could play. In the published version of it, I dedicate the kind of play, as it were, to the invisible cat, wherever she is. And the cat was the one character who I couldn't somehow work in. And I was very interested in the cat, because the cat was never around when there was work to be done, but always around when there was food to be had. And she intrigued me, but I just couldn't fit her in. But I suppose if I did it again today, I'd try and get the cat in somewhere, because I think that that's another human trait that is universal and could well be dramatized and could well be very almost comical, because I think one of the things about the piece is that you have to remember it is a satire. And whilst it's on the one hand very nightmarish and very menacing, it's also in some respects quite hilarious, because power in its many forms is often very funny whilst also being often very menacing.
Yes, there are some images of the pig sprawled on the bed, and you know, various, you know, getting drunk on the whatever, and also the boxer, the horse, who says, you know, if he says this, it's always got to be true, and you can hear that sort of well, of course, and it's very funny, but also being very scary, but it's very funny.
Yes, it is, because it's naive. And it's innocent, and it's totally trusting, but probably as an audience, you know, people know that that's a rather ridiculous view of the world, that we do trust leaders to a certain extent, but we have to be very wary about what they're coming up with, because otherwise we end up in a very dangerous place.
Are you going to have an opportunity to come here and see this production?
Unfortunately not. I'm really sorry about that. And I am thrilled. I have to say that Milwaukee Repertory Theatre are doing it. It's a major American theatre, and I'm really honoured to have them perform a piece of work that I had a part in making. I've visited America many, many times in the past, and I've worked over there. But unfortunately, while it's on, I'm going to be working in Mexico and also here in London. But I wish the company all the very, very best. I'm sure they'll make a marvelous job of it. I've looked at, you know, the designs, and I've seen the little videos that the company's put out about, you know, the production. And it sounds tremendous. I mean, really. I'm sure Milwaukee audiences, Wisconsin audiences are going to be highly entertained, but also, very excited about what they're going to witness.
Well, Ian Wooldridge, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for taking time.
My pleasure, too. Good talking to you.
British writer Ian Wooldridge speaking by phone with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. Wooldridge wrote the adaptation of George Orwell's Animal Farm, which is now on stage at the Milwaukee Rep through February 11th.
One last break, and then we meet an entrepreneur who is bringing in a big haul in Milwaukee. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Lots of us use the beginning of a new year as a push to purge. Maybe clean out the basement or finally donate a pile of clothes you haven't worn for a decade.
An entrepreneur based northwest of Milwaukee has turned decluttering into a million-dollar business. But WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz learned there's a lot more to the hauling business than financial success.
Eileen Wines commands J-Dog Junk Removal and Hauling Headquarters in Butler, 12 miles northwest of Milwaukee, with authority.
This is our catch-all room. The truck's back up right here.
Eileen picks her way through mounds of hula hoops, exercise equipment, and furniture.
This whole pile is the Goodwill pile.
J-Dog donates some of the stuff its crews remove. Some can be sold and repurposed. The business has just moved into this 28,000-square-foot building, which, under a previous owner, housed dozens of huge oil tanks.
This is filled with sludge. So every tank before it left here was, it was like a foot deep in here of sludge. They cleaned it out, and then they power wash it.
Eileen says some developers wouldn't touch the place, but she and her husband, who've run a home improvement business for 25 years, see its potential.
And we see the vision. Like, I know by the end of June, this place will be rocking.
While Eileen plays a key role in day-to-day operations, her son Andrew Wines actually owns J-Dog.
This business allows me to take care of the environment.
The original J-Dog came to life 7 years ago in Philadelphia. A military veteran created the business model and now awards franchises to fellow veterans and their families. Andrew fits the criteria, having served both in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
We push the fact that we're veteran-owned and operated because from a marketing standpoint, it's a competitive advantage, right? We're the only company like that. However, I'm here for environmental responsibility. That's my goal and my mission in life. Just so happens, J-Dog allows me to get into it.
But if you think Andrew's sole motivation is environmental, you're about to learn otherwise.
I've been an unemployed vet twice. I came back from two deployments without a job. I've been a homeless vet. I've been there, working for small businesses that didn't give me an opportunity, or they didn't like the way I did business, or I wasn't there long enough.
19 months ago, after three failed business attempts, Andrew launched a bare-bone J-Dog from his kitchen table.
One truck, one trailer, one part-time employee. Now, in total, we have 10 trucks, 13 trailers, 20 employees across three states.
And he's planning ahead.
5-year mark, our goal is to have a crew about between 180 and 220 with a 50% veteran retention rate. So I want to hire 100 veterans across the Midwest and Southern California.
Andrew explains what he's looking for in employees.
There's two groups of people that we always hire, veterans and felons, guys and girls that need and want and desire a second chance. The only skills that you need to work for us is a good attitude and a willingness to learn.
The things that haven't been sorted.
Not every J-Dog employee falls under the mantle of felons and veterans. Jerome Holmes temped on a big J-Dog job and was hired on the spot for his metal scrapping expertise.
Just so happened, I found these guys and they gave me the opportunity of my life, so here I am.
Jerome's skills are invaluable to J-Dog, but Andrew Wines knows his employee wants more.
When we sat down with Jerome on his 90-day review, he said, I want to learn more. I want to take on a truck. I want to do these things. So we train him to do more.
Because any meeting I go to now, right when I walk in, everyone's like, oh, J-Dog's here.
Robert Morris is a veteran. He served in West Germany during the Cold War era. At J-Dog's daily 7 a.m. staff meeting, Robert stands out. Pant legs tucked neatly in his boots, jacket impeccably clean. His colleagues call him G.I. Joe, but Robert says when he left the service and after, he floundered.
Not
being able to deal with things that I'd seen or done, not knowing how to deal with those things. There didn't seem to be a way to climb up.
A relative told him about J-Dog. Robert immediately reached out and now thinks back to his first conversation with owner Andrew Wines.
Talked to me on the phone and said, I'm going to ask you three questions. What do you like? What do you want to do? And what don't you like? And I said, I like the idea of belonging to a company like this. I like what you stand for.
Robert says at age 52, he wasn't keen about lifting and hauling heavy materials the rest of his career. What he likes is sales.
I like talking to the people. I like promoting. I like being, you know, out there for the company. He's like, well, that's my job. Do you think you can do my job? And I thought, well, I have nothing to lose at this point. So I said, yeah, I'll do your job.
Owner Andrew Wine says the success bubbling around him is easier to explain than you might think.
We communicate effectively and we're kind. That's it.
And Andrew adds with a smile, his mom, Eileen, keeps him in line. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
You can see pictures from Susan's story at WUWM.com.
We've spoken on this show before with Milwaukeean Adam Carr. He's been on the show for a variety of projects, from public art to a children's book he had a hand in.
But one story that hadn't been told was what drives the seemingly tireless Carr. Lake Effect's Aisha Turner went in search of the answer to that question and learned about how he's using his unique role in Milwaukee to shape a new kind of community.
Back when Adam Carr was a radio producer, he was a bit of a tumbleweed, rolling into communities, telling stories, and leaving before he really had a chance to establish a connection. Now, as a freelancer, he's changed his approach.
I'm not exactly a tumbleweed. I'm kind of like a truck with a bed full of plants on it that drives around.
Sticking up dirt.
Yeah, I'm sticking up dirt.
Adam is still one of those people that pops up all over the city. I found that when his name comes up in conversation, someone will tell me, oh yeah, Adam Carr, I know that guy. It's often followed with, so what does he do anyway?
I've always been a little bit chameleonic. Like, I've always been a person that's participated in many communities and had friends and participated in the city in a way that's been really broad, I guess.
Here's a quick background. He grew up in Milwaukee. He attended Rufus King. Then he went to college in Minnesota. And after graduating in 2007, he spent a little time abroad. Then he wound up back in the city, canvassing for the 2008 elections and working for 88.9. Now, he just kind of does his own thing. Adam takes pictures, he's been involved in public art projects, he's written a children's book about Milwaukee, and he does web work for the Neighborhood News Service.
The basic definition that I will give for what I do here is I work in Milwaukee at the intersection of community and communication.
Sometimes those intersections are literal. Occasionally on Saturday afternoons, you'll find him on a yellow school bus, introducing Milwaukeeans to parts of the city they'd never been before, or maybe teaching them the history of a place they'd been but had never really thought much about.
Hey, I'm Adam Carr. I will be your tour guide today.
And one recent tour started at Haymarket Square Park. He took participants around to see some of the places key to the 1967 open housing marches.
When we do get off the bus, let's just try to be a relatively well-oiled machine. Don't wander off. If we do a head count and we're a couple short, you just have to take an Uber. We'll just know you're gone, so we're not going to look for you. Just kidding.
On this Saturday afternoon, Adam's experiences collide. Adam is also the co-chair of the March on Milwaukee 50th, an ongoing effort to honor the city's civil rights history and spur contemporary activism.
You never know what kind of opportunities will arise, and I think the opportunity to be involved in the 50th anniversary of one of the most important untold stories, I do frequently remind myself of, like, wow, it's really lucky that I get to be a part of it.
He says the committee's work doesn't come without its challenges.
We're an extremely intergenerational group. We're a group of people across a lot of different sectors and backgrounds. I think the story itself and its legacy and its in the current moment of our city, there's some really complex racial dynamics that exist in doing the work. This is sort of like taking all the different nuances of the different languages or cultural languages that I've come to understand or speak. It sort of asked me to use all of them.
He's gained that experience by traversing so many communities. And I thought that maybe he does this work all over the city in celebration of the city because he loves this place. He told me it's not that simple.
I love Milwaukee in a way that it breaks my heart almost every day. I feel let down by it because I feel like it's capable of so much more than what it does.
He points to the city's racial and economic disparities as part of his disappointment. He also gets frustrated when he sees privileged communities ignore the problems that persist.
then what makes me like love being here is that the people that I feel connected to, who I work alongside every day, and the people who are doing incredible work around Milwaukee, is that like a lot of what people are doing to untangle that dysfunction or offer alternatives to the dysfunction, like other ways of being and seeing each other and relating to each other and building communities, like that makes me feel optimistic. So I guess like I love being here is that even though we have like a lethargic civic dialogue a lot of times, what makes me feel love for this place is that like there are a lot of people that are building an alternative to like this lethargy and this amnesia that we have in the city.
I'm Aisha Turner, 89.7 WUWM.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Ramaya Family Foundation.
That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Lake Effect still has an opening for aspiring college journalists who would like the chance to intern with a hardworking daily radio show. You can find out more about Lake Effect's internships at the About WUWM tab at WUWM.com.
Thank you so much for listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.